You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the Disease is Your Podcast. I'm your host, Carly Sisson, and in this episode, I spoke with Dr. Ben Espy about subfertility in mares. This episode of Disease du Jour is brought to you by Equithrive. Dr. Benjamin Espy received a biology degree from Duke University in 1991. In 1996, he became a doctor of veterinary medicine at Texas A&M University. After completing a residency in Lexington, Kentucky in 2005, Dr. Espy became recognized as a board-certified specialist in equine reproduction, infertility, and neonatology. During his career, Dr. Espy has practiced equine medicine in Brenham, Texas, Lexington, Kentucky at Highgard Equine Medical Institute, and most recently in San Antonio, Texas. He is the past chairman of the AAEP Owner Education Committee, served on the AAEP Board of Directors, the Board of Directors for the American College of Theriogenology, and on the King Ranch Board of Directors. Dr. Espy has also served as the AAEP liaison for the Board of Directors of the Texas Equine Veterinary Association. He serves on the Ethics and Grievance Committee for the Texas Veterinary Medical Examiners, teaches in the Texas A&M University System, and is on the AVMA Board of Directors. Besides being the King Ranch veterinarian since 2005, Dr. Espy currently practices sports and regenerative medicine almost exclusively on professional rough stock and rodeo-timed event horses, as well as being the reproductive consultant. Because of this unique skill set, he is licensed in 6 states. He has been the head of veterinary services at the San Antonio Stock Show and Rodeo since 1996. Since 2011, Dr. Espy has been a consultant on the Animal Care and Welfare Committee for the Professional Rodeo Cowboy Association. He was a 7-time finalist every year from 2016 to 2021 for the PRCA Veterinarian of the Year, and won the award in 2021. Thank you, Dr. Espy, for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I think this is a problem that a lot of practitioners probably encounter to some degree or another. To get us started, how do you define subfertility in mares?
Well, I think subfertility in mares has to be delineated by what type of breeding you're doing. We still do have mare turnout with stallions, and then we also have cooled semen and frozen semen, and then we also have the population of horses that we have a lot of data on now being feral horses. So we have feral horses, obviously, which are in their natural habitat, and they have a standard fertility percentage. Then we also have assisted fertility, meaning, you know, ship semen that everybody's familiar with. But of course, that's extended with antibiotics and shipped in a FedEx truck on an airplane and all that kind of stuff. So you have a lot of variables. And so I think generally the percentage of success is kind of how we rate fertility, although there are a lot of variables that go into that percentage. So, for instance, there was a new census done recently, and we have 41,000 feral horses in the United States, and their fertility rate has been tracked at 31%. So, beyond the very overwhelming numbers that presents to us as humans, so we have 40,000 wild horses, which means we'll have 12,000 foals next year, which is another subject, and it's very frustrating for people in my community trying to provide for horse welfare. You move on to mares turned out with stallions. That typically is, you know, 75% success rate is pretty standard when we're breeding bucking horses, which I have a lot of experience with. We like to see 70-75% as normal. I would say in most successful cooled semen stallions, meaning that they're shipped and 24 hours later the semen arrives, those mares are your typically looking at like a 65 to 75% success rate. And then when you do frozen semen, that semen has been damaged twice, meaning it's been frozen and then it's been stored and then it's been thawed out. So the freezing process and the thawing process damages the product twice. And so we feel very fortunate if we're getting like 30 to 40% on those horses.
Right. And then do those figures account for differences in stallion motility too?
Yes, and that's kind of what I was referring to when I said there's a lot of variables, because yes, you're right. Stallion, some stallions like certain extenders, some stallions like to be cooled, some stallions don't like to be frozen. They're all variables. So the averages I'm giving you are what we consider to be normal, even though a lot of what we consider to be normal is not really normal, because going back to the feral horse analogy, normal really in nature is 30-35%. So people get frustrated at our lack of success, but honestly, it's much better than nature typically.
Yeah, that's a good point. So what are some of the primary causes of subfertility, and how do you go about figuring out which one of those is at play with a particular mare?
Well, I'm boarded in reproduction, so there are a lot of people like me that are focused on reproduction and neonatology. And what I have spent my career doing is focusing on the mare. There are a lot of people that are far more qualified, whether they've done a residency in reproduction or whether they've just been practicing veterinarians. I have never thought about being an expert in male fertility. I actually think of myself as deficient in most areas when dealing with male fertility, but with female fertility, I feel very comfortable assessing that. I would say that in general, one of the things I kind of mention when I'm asked to talk to groups is that foaling and really child rearing or pregnancy is an athletic event. And you see it in humans also. You know, it's the physical standards it takes to carry a baby, whether it's human or horse or cow or whatever, it's demanding, obviously, for the female. The amount of fluid that it's required, the weight that you're required to carry. We ask mares to do a lot, and we ask human females to do a lot when carrying a pregnancy. So I think that the take-home message that I usually tell people is that you want fat coverage on mares to allow them to cycle correctly. And you can't have mares too skinny, will not cycle correctly, because they're obviously their caloric expenditure is focused on survival, not necessarily reproduction. And then so you move into the ideal body weight or body condition scores of like fives and six out of nine. And those body condition scores are ideal for fertility. And then mares that get obese become, you know, they're more likely to get sore. They're more likely to have difficulties in the actual foaling process because of the fat in inside the pelvis. So we don't like to see mares too obese as they approach foaling. The general consensus in my community is that we feed pregnant mares the same as we feed geldings. The only exception to that is the last trimester of pregnancy. So all of my pregnant mares are fed just like castrated males until the last 3 months of pregnancy. So I think that's the main thing, is that people will get a mare pregnant and then they start hammering her with excessive feed. And then so you can imagine by the end of gestation at 11 months, they're quite overweight. So
yeah,
I think that's
a great point.
And then I think, too, conformation is really important, because if you have a skinny horse, when you lift up the tail of a horse, you know, a lot of the times we get fixated on the ultrasound and the vaginal conformation of a mare, meaning that everything is, you know, you're kind of focused on the hind end, you know, the ovaries, the uterus, the vulva, culturing uteruses, all that kind of stuff. And then it's really good practice to kind of don't forget to be a horseman, meaning that when you walk up to a mare, you need to kind of assess her body weight, body condition, and then fixate on the actual reproductive organs. And then you'll have, you know, typical external problems with skinny horses. Their anus will sink forward and their vulva will tilt forward, and they'll tend to pool urine, and they'll tend to have repetitive problems with uterine infections and things like that. So ideal body weight is good not only for fertility reasons, but also for just the mechanical orientation of the reproductive organs. Because what people tend to forget is, like, humans, for instance, are biped organisms, meaning they stand vertical, whereas horses are quadrupeds. So they're all on their them standing on four legs means that their uterus is oriented horizontally. And so the duration of a horse's life, you're fighting gravity. Like the older a horse gets, the more its uterus sinks down into her abdomen. And so you're kind of fighting age and fighting gravity. And so there are some pretty basic ideas that you can do to kind of offset that risk.
This episode of Disease du Jour is sponsored by Equithrive. Brought to you by Equithrive, the leaders in resveratrol science, Medicare is a new pelleted daily supplement offering metabolic support for easy keepers. Medicare was formulated by Pat Lawless, PhD, to support optimum carbohydrate and fat metabolism, healthy body weight, and appropriate insulin levels in horses, thanks to a proprietary combination of resveratrol, flavonoids, and amino acids. Learn more at www.equithrive.com. What role does age play in fertility as well? Like, I know that it's going to decline pretty dramatically as they age, but what years do you think are sort of prime fertility years for mares?
Well, you see this keep going back and forth with humans, but I use the analogy a lot because people are able to understand the theory. So there are many examples, obviously, of very old men, you know, 65, 70-year-old men having babies with young females. And the reason is because in the male species or the male gender, their semen is recycled every 6 weeks. So the sperm that comes out of a male of any age, whether they're 70 or 25 years old, is only 6 weeks old at the most. Very similar to horses. So you can have a very aged stallion that successfully breeds mares because his semen, no matter when you pull it, is going to be no more than 6 weeks old. So now females, humans, and female horses, and female cows, and female foxes, and so on, they are born with their full complement of oocytes, meaning that a human female at 40 years old, the reason her fertility decreases is because her oocytes that she is ovulating are 40 years old. So it's not necessarily that her body cannot carry a pregnancy. It's more that the oocytes are very, very, are decades old. And the same with a horse. So the oocytes that a mare ovulates at 20 are literally 20 years old. So the genetic material in an oocyte in a 15-year-old mare, for instance, is 15 years old, which is obviously a lot different than the six-week-old semen that comes out of the stallion. So that's sort of why, you know, when we have mares, we just have to, they're kind of set up to fail. And So that's the reason all of the external part, you know, the feeding, the vulvar anatomy, the uterus, the ultrasounds, the uterine cultures, all that kind of stuff is important because when you start dealing with a middle-aged mare, you're dealing with very, very aged genetic material to start with.
Is there any truth that it's easier to breed an older mare who's had foals earlier in life versus an older maiden mare?
Yes, there's a lot of truth to that, and there's data that supports that. Horses are not females or human females, meaning that it's very common in humans to have two pregnancies and go back to work, or maybe you have four pregnancies and then you decide that you're finished, or maybe you take 2 years off between babies or whatever. In horses, it's not that way at all. In horses, it's very, very, very important to keep a uterus pregnant. And what I mean by that is you kind of have to be very cautious about anthropomorphizing them. And that means giving them human-like qualities because horses are not people, meaning that the uterus of a horse, if it's not supplying blood to another organism, meaning it's not pregnant, then they build up scar tissue and fibrotic tissue. So the longer a horse lives unpregnant, then the more scar tissue that will build up. Likewise, the more you miss cycles, meaning that, let's just say a mare has a foal, the more years you go in before you get her pregnant again will decrease your chances of getting her pregnant because that fibrotic tissue is building up. So if you can keep a mare pregnant, her uterus, and this is not my opinion, but this is like histologically, her uterus is healthier by having to support another organism. When a mare is empty, all they do is build up scar tissue. And so that's the whole kind of old wives' tale that actually happens to be true, is that if you start breeding a 17-year-old mare, for instance, for the first time, then you are not only battling her 17-year-old oocyte, you're not only battling her tilted vulva that allows for contamination of the uterus, but you're also dealing with the scarring in her uterus that's normal.
Right. Yeah. Sort of a recipe for disaster.
Yes, exactly. And then people get frustrated and confused about what's going on. Actually, I always remind people it's actually quite amazing that we get horses pregnant at all, because I think people have gotten spoiled and fixated on, you know, getting, you know, you take your mare to the vet or a breeding farm and they don't conceive and everybody's like, what's wrong? What's wrong? It's like, well, you know, that's nature.
Yeah. So what are some of the most effective treatment and management strategies to help improve fertility outcomes in some of these subfertile mares?
Well, what I do with all my mares, and this is, again, not my opinion, but medical fact, is, you know, mares are the only animal we know on Earth that have a defined breeding season determined by length of day. So we try to capitalize that. On that, there's been lots of data written, magazine articles and textbook chapters and so on that describe lighting mares. And so not only do we know that lighting mares increases the speed at which they reach their breeding season, but it also shortens the gestation, which is important because, like, for instance, if you breed a mare in February for, you know, hoping for a January foal, it's very common that mare goes 12, 13 months during her gestation. And so, in other words, the mare is going to try to have her baby deeper into the spring than humans want. So, like, just for example, if you breed a mare in February, it would be completely normal for that mare to go 13 months and have her mare or have her baby in March or April, because she's trying to get deeper in the spring where the weather's warmer. So the way you counteract that is by giving them 60 days of lighting. And so that helps in every type of gender, meaning that it helps mares that are non-pregnant, it helps them cycle. In mares that are older, it helps them cycle. In mares that are pregnant, it helps them have their baby faster so we can get them rebred. So there's no downside to lighting mares. And that's probably the number one thing I suggest to people when I'm starting to get phone calls, as you can imagine, when people are doing stallion contracts this time of year.
Yeah.
I always remind them, I'm like, okay, well, my practice is primarily pro rodeo. So I always remind people the two dates that people can fixate on are Thanksgiving, which is essentially December 1, and the NFR.
Yeah.
And so I always tell people, I'm like, whatever is good for your iPhone calendar to remember, that's when you need to start lighting, because it takes 60 days. So if you start lighting December 1, then you're going to be, your mare should be starting to cycle by February 1.
Yeah, that's a great tip. What about when you're dealing with a mare who has endometritis? What are some of your strategies there? And especially now that we're growing more concerned about antimicrobial resistance, do you have any tips for dealing with some of these tricky cases?
Well, some of the things that are discussed now, there's a colleague of mine named Ryan Ferris, who's very accomplished repro specialist, and he has written a lot of great documents about treating biofilm. And biofilm is easiest to think of the slimy mucus like material that prohibits antibiotics from reaching bacteria. So biofilm is probably the hottest thing on the topic today for people like me who are repro specialists. So we are very cognizant about treating biofilm. So in other words, we used to say, okay, well, our uterine culture was a strep or a pseudomonas or a staph or whatever it was. And then we'd fixate on the antibiotics that would be targeted towards that specific bug. Well, now we also use a lot of aggressive techniques that are determined to break down the slime that's associated with the bacteria. And it doesn't necessarily have to mean like visible slime to the human naked eye, but it's like a film that covers the bacteria. And so there are all types of stuff that we use. We use hydrogen peroxide, we use DMSO, We use kerosene. We use EDTA, which is the liquid that comes in the purple top blood tubes. So there are lots of different additives that we put in IV fluids to flush uteruses out. So those are all different techniques. And a lot of that depends on your skill level, the timing. You obviously, there are certain, some of the products you can't mix with some of the antibiotics. And so there are little subtleties about techniques like that. But just in general, that people probably don't know is the hottest topic is just the biofilm issue. So we use a lot of mechanical things now. We're mechanically flushing. Some of the techniques that we're trying to get away from is there are a lot of veterinarians that will put flush or put fluid into a uterus using a insemination pipette, which is like a really small gauge, almost like a plastic straw.
Yeah.
And most of the people that do a lot of brood mares prefer the Bavona catheter, which is like a big, it's almost like the size of a garden hose. So I'm still using sterile IV fluids, but I'm putting them in at very, very high speeds and flushing them out at very high speeds. So we're almost using like the mechanical flushing aspect, much like you would flush an abscess with a garden hose type thing.
Yeah, interesting. Have you had any experience or success using any alternative therapies like PRP for some of these tricky cases?
Yes, I use PRP a lot. And honestly, PRP has become more common in my practice because I do a lot of sports medicine. And so I do have a PRP centrifuge in my car. So I do use PRP. But I don't, to be completely truthful with the audience, I also do a lot of very generic non-PRP stuff. Like I'll pull 60 cc's of blood off of a mare and literally put it in a refrigerator for 2 hours or 4 hours, whatever it is, and allow the blood to settle. And then so you'll get 30 or 40 cc's of serum off of that. So we don't necessarily think it's the actual plasma spinning to harvest the PRP like you would on a tendon or a joint.
Right.
We think that those same beneficial product or beneficial elements of blood products are in the serum. So a lot of times I don't want to say I'm lazy, but a lot of times I just will pull like 60 cc's of blood and I don't know if you've seen one of those syringes, but they're giant syringes, you know, and they'll just stand upright on their own, and I'll just put it in the fridge. And then, you know, every couple hours I'll just see if it's settled out and, you know, like the red cells and the liquid will separate.
Yeah.
And I'll just, you know, use those, just the liquid from the blood product.
And has that been making a big difference in your practice, do you think?
Yeah, I feel like it does. We don't really know what it does, but, you know, it's very similar with eyes. Eyes are very sensitive or responsive to serum products. So usually I'll use the typical, you know, antibiotic, you know, flushing protocols, and then I'll get maybe two cycles, three cycles into a mare, and I'll just kind of at that point abandon ship and go towards the blood product.
Okay, interesting.
But there's not, I mean, I it's funny, and I think it's mainly because it's mainly my personality. There's no downside to using it initially. It's just the cost, you know.
Yeah.
So, but I think to your point, going back to the 17-year-old mare example, you know, if you had a mare that had never been bred and you were starting at 15 or 17 or whatever it was, then yeah, I mean, that's a mare that would benefit probably up front with serum products.
So at what point do you consider some advanced reproductive techniques for horses that are subfertile, like embryo transfer, ICSI? You know, when do you sort of call it off for doing it the traditional way and start to move to some of these other methods?
Well, I think people have to understand that there are four different organs that you're dealing with.
Yep.
And depending on the organ that has pathology is going to make your decision. It's not a human decision, meaning that it's not difficult to understand when you kind of break it down. So you have the ovaries that are dealing with genetic material that's a decade old. Can they ovulate? Can they get their oocyte into the fallopian tubes in preparation for fertilization? So in other words, are your ovaries abnormal? Okay, number one thing. Second thing is your uterus. Does it have enough blood flow? Does it have too much scar tissue? Does it have fluid accumulation? Does it have no tone to it? Does it have bacterial or fungal infection? Okay, moving backwards, the cervix. Is the cervix competent? Does the cervix open between, you know, during a heat cycle and close in between cycles? If it doesn't open and close normally as a dynamic structure, then you can't protect the interior of the uterus. So you can have perfect semen, perfect ovaries, perfect uterus, and if the cervix doesn't close actively, then you have no options. And then the last thing, the fourth item, is obviously the external barrier, meaning the vulvar seal. So if the vulva is tilted forward, if the mare is emaciated or obese and you've lost that seal, when you take the lips of a horse vulva and separate them, you should get a sucking sound, meaning that there's negative pressure in that vagina. And so if you have lost that vulvar seal, then it doesn't matter what every other organ is doing in front of that vulva. If you don't have a seal to the entire reproductive tract, then you just have, you know, very, very few options. So those are, when you talk about like whether you should do ICSI or whether you should do embryo transfer, you have to decide, okay, so ICSI, obviously you're sticking a needle into the ovary, so you're eliminating the entire reproductive tract. You're just basically harvesting an egg. When you do embryo transfer, it's obviously much cheaper, but to do embryo transfer, you are harvesting your embryo 5 or 6 days, 7 days after fertilization. So your uterus, so you have to have a good ovary, you have to have a normal fallopian tube, and you have to have a uterus that can maintain a pregnancy for a week.
Right.
For embryo transfer to work. So those are perfect examples of why people use ICSI and people use embryo transfers. Because if a mare is normal, then you can harvest 2 to 3 embryos a year off of her.
Right.
ICSI, it's very common to harvest 20 oocytes on one procedure and literally put her back in the competition arena the next day.
Yeah.
And you pay for that. And you pay for that convenience and you pay for that technology. So it just depends.
I know a lot of people use ICSI on older mares, but is there still a lower success rate using it on older mares because you're working with the older genetic material?
Yes, you answered your own question. Because no matter if you're successful and you harvest 17 oocytes or whatever it is on your ICSI harvest, it doesn't matter. Because if you take your ICSI derived oocyte, meaning you've pulled it out of the ovary with a needle, and then you take those 17 oocytes and you put them in petri dishes, and you mechanically put the sperm, which is what you're doing. It's called intracytoplasmic sperm injection. You're taking the head of the sperm and you're literally sticking it with a needle into the oocyte. I mean, the fact that we can do that is honestly pretty crazy.
I know.
Right? So we're literally pushing a sperm into an egg. And we get 20% success, 30% success. And it all goes back to what you're saying about the genetic material, because you're starting with a genetic material that's been sitting there for 12 years, 14 years, whatever it is. So that, again, like you pointed out, is the limiting factor. Like, in other words, I'm watching through a microscope. Like, I know the egg is fertilized, right?
Yeah.
Because I'm taking the sperm and putting it in the egg. And then the large majority of those oocytes don't germinate, don't develop.
Interesting. Yeah, definitely more of a high cost, high risk procedure, but I guess some people, it's still worth it to try.
Yeah. And if you've got a damaged uterus or your cervix is incompetent, or maybe the cervix has been torn during a past foaling experience or something, I mean, there are definitely reasons to do ICSI. And here's another thing I'll point out too. There are a lot of dead stallions that only allow ICSI. And the reason is because they have frozen straws of semen from a dead stallion or an infertile stallion. And you just have to take one sperm.
Yeah.
So there are reasons to use ICSI for sure. But, you know, it doesn't come without incredibly high cost and incredibly large amount of failure.
Right. So before we wrap up today, are there any new developments or research that you believe will impact how we manage subfertility in mares in the future?
I don't really know that. I guess I would say that a lot of the, you know, a lot of the standard techniques that we have used to increase our knowledge of horse anatomy and sports medicine and, say, spinal cord injury and that kind of thing has really been earth-shattering. I mean, to think, like, I'm 56, so I've been out of school for 30 years. So just to think what's happened in my, just in my career alone, you know, we've gone from not even having MRIs to standing MRIs to, you know, standing CT scans, which are new, PET scans, which were formerly used just in oncology units and human hospitals. We basically have an unlimited amount of technology. I actually recently had a pelvis fracture in a foal that was slid into a diagnostic tube.
Oh, wow.
Meaning that before, until a few years ago, you know, we just were doing legs and maybe a head every now and then. Now we're sliding the entire pelvis of a horse into a tube, which was unheard of 2, 3, 4 years ago. So that's all really cool and awesome. But, you know, we've kind of toyed around with technology, meaning that, like, are there some dyes that we can use to image the uterus, or is there something interesting that we can kind of advance our understanding of the reproductive tract with? And I think, honestly, it's, you know, like, I would say a really nice ultrasound now is between $30,000 and $35,000. And, you know, all of us that do this, we have Doppler on our ultrasound, which shows blood flow. And so our ultrasounds at this point are the same ultrasounds that OBGYNs use in human hospitals. So I mean, the technology in ultrasound has increased dramatically in the last decade. And so we do have very, very advanced, expensive machines that we use. But honestly, the techniques are all the same, because the tissue that we're looking at is so deep inside of a horse. It all relies on, you know, rectal palpation and the use of an ultrasound. There's not many other prospects for machines that are going to be able to get into that, just because the horse's mass is so big, right?
Yeah.
So you just can't get close to the uterus with a machine. I mean, other than an ultrasound.
Right.
So, but anyway, to answer your question, yeah, I don't see any like high tech stuff that is, you know, prospects for imaging or diagnosing or anything like that. There's just not, it's just the physical mass of a horse kind of limits the technology available.
Right. But it seems like overall the industry has really benefited just from advances in technology over time. So that's really great.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think also too, just like you said, I mean, it's funny because, you know, the PRP, putting PRP in the uterus has got really hip when we started using PRP for joints and tendons. And then the funny thing is, going back to my serum analogy, I was in Central Kentucky for like 8 years. And, you know, that's where I learned pulling blood and just leaving it on the counter. Meaning that was done like 30 years ago. We knew about the serum. And now it's funny because all the younger generation is like, oh, yeah, we should use PRP in the uterus. And I'm thinking, well, we were doing that like 30 years ago. But just leaving the syringe, like literally we would just leave the syringe on the counter of the repro lab. And then like when the blood settled out, we'd stick it in the mare's uterus, you know. I will be honest, we didn't know what it was doing like we do now. But it was being tried for sure.
Yeah, that's super interesting to see how that came full circle.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Espy, again for joining us today. I really appreciate having you on the episode.
Yeah. Well, I'll look forward to seeing you again if I need to.
I would like to say a big thank you again to Dr. Espy for joining us, and thank you to EquiThrive for supporting this episode. And as always, thank you to our audience for listening to Disease Du Jour. If you have any questions or suggestions for the podcast, please send me an email at csysin@equinenetwork.com.